This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
America's the greatest idea the world's ever had. And we've got to fight every day to make sure that everyone who wants to contribute to the idea that is America is able to.
What would U.S. energy policy look like if we had more committed progressives in Congress? Our guest today on Sea Change Radio, Ray Linzenmeyer, hopes he can help us find out. Just weeks ago, Democrat Connor Lamb narrowly beat Republican Rick Saccone in a Pennsylvania special election to fill a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. Now, Connor Lamb finds himself having to run again in a different, newly created congressional district, the primary set for May 15th. Ray Linzenmeyer is among Lamb's Democratic challengers. Linzenmeyer is a former executive in the renewable energy space and an unabashed progressive. We ask him to help us sort out the confusing political landscape in Pennsylvania, with its redistricting, gerrymandering, and special elections, learn more about his positions on energy solutions like carbon capture and storage, and we find out what's driving him to run for Congress. Then we dig into the Sea Change Radio archives and learn more about desalination technology from energy reporter Sammy Roth. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Ray Linzenmeyer. He's running as a Democrat in the 17th District of Pennsylvania. That primary is on May 15th. Ray, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much, Alex. Good to be here.
So I wanted to have you on. You have a background in the renewable energy space, and I want to dive into your background soon. But before that, take a step back, if you will, and fill our listeners in on the very complex political landscape that's underway this season in Pennsylvania. You're running in the 17th, correct?
Yes, the 17th, a district that didn't exist until about, I guess, 3 weeks or 4 weeks ago. The 17th is a combination of parts of three districts that existed before. The Pennsylvania 12th, where I live and where I grew up. The Pennsylvania 18th. And the Pennsylvania 14th, which was a district that was mainly in the city of Pittsburgh.
And there was just a special election. What district was that in? And I've heard that Saccone, who just lost to Connor Lamb there, could just slide over to the neighboring district and run again. So they very well may end up being colleagues in the House of Representatives this fall. It's pretty crazy what's going on.
You know, that's quite possible. They're in. There is no requirement to run when you're running for Congress, no requirement to actually live in the district that you represent. Sometimes it's a little bit politically tricky, but there is no legal requirement that you live in the district that you run in.
Explain, if you will, how gerrymandering has affected your state and what you would like to do to change it if you're elected to Congress.
So gerrymandering is actually a state issue. I think every state does it a little bit differently, but in Pennsylvania, every 10 years after the census, the state house and the state senate negotiate a bill that's signed by the governor and then approved by the court that lays out the congressional, the state representative, and the state senate districts for the state. Now, in 2010, after the census, an election where the Republicans won the state house, the state senate, and the governor's mansion, they redistricted or gerrymandered Pennsylvania in a way that was very, very, very favorable to the Republicans. It was so favorable to the Republicans that the Republican Supreme Court in 2010 threw the map out. And it was only in 2012 when a new map that was still very favorable to the Republicans, a new map was created and implemented. And we have been under that map, that 2012 map, until just a few weeks ago, where the state Supreme Court instituted a new map for the congressional districts. The state house and the state senate districts are still the same.
And so is there a voter ID law in your state, Ray?
There is a voter ID law, but it's limited. The only time you can be required to show identification is if you are voting in the voting district for the first time. In every case, you're allowed to submit a provisional ballot, and that's the only time you can be required to present ID. I always tell everybody, if you show up to a voting place that you know you're eligible to vote in, you can always, at the very least, fill out a provisional ballot that will be counted and analyzed based on your living in that district.
And let's talk a little bit more about your district. We mm-hmm. Now that we know that it exists, because it didn't exist till recently, as you mentioned, where is it in Western Pennsylvania? And what are the demographics? And maybe give us a quick snapshot of your competition.
The district goes from the Ohio border. It covers all of Beaver County, which is a county, the first county east of the Ohio border in the very western part of the state, and it covers a large portion of Allegheny County, not the city of Pittsburgh, but the northern suburbs, a lot of the southwestern suburbs, and a lot of the southeastern suburbs as well. There's about 705,000 people in the district, which is consistent with other congressional districts in the country, with about 400,000 some registered voters. It is a district that Donald Trump won by, I believe, 2 percentage points. So it's a very, very much a swing district now. It's a lot of suburbs and a little bit of urban territory in Beaver County.
So there's three people in the Democratic primary. Who are they?
First of all, yeah, there've been seven people that have been part of this primary. It has changed dramatically over the last few weeks. People have been coming in and out of the primary, but the other day there was a deadline to file petition signatures to get actually on the ballot, and only three people filed signatures to get on the ballot. I did. Beth Terese, who's a lawyer from one of the areas here in Swickley, and Connor Lamb. The three of us were the only ones that filed petitions to get onto the ballot.
And who is running on the Republican side?
Right now, the only person is Keith Rothfuss. He is the incumbent congressman for the district. He was the incumbent congressman for the Pennsylvania 12th since 2012. And he is running unopposed for the Republican primary. And he will face off against one of the three of us, whoever wins the primary on May 15th.
Let's talk it over. Let's get it straight. Don't let the situation escalate. You know there's always problems when a man is wrapped up in his heart. But don't you worry, baby. You can count on me to do my part.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to congressional candidate Ray Linsenmeyer. He's running in the 17th district in Pennsylvania. The primary is May 15th. So why are you running? Tell us a little bit more about Ray Linsenmeyer and what motivated you to throw your hat in the ring.
Look, I think that people right now are really sort of angry, and they don't know why they're angry, but they're angry. They're not getting a fair shake, and they know they're not. And you know, they know, you know, that almost 80% of the people in this country who work full time are living in paycheck to paycheck at least some portion of the time. And that's frankly how I grew up as well. So it's one of the things that I really feel, and one of the things I'm really trying to fix. But you know, there are real issues that underlie this problem. And rather than providing solutions to these issues, you know, a lot of the people on the other side, I think, I mean, Donald Trump and Keith Rothfuss, who's an incumbent congressman here, they're telling people sort of who to blame for all these issues and for all these problems. And then so all of a sudden it's been sort of okay, and people have gotten cover in this country to be, you know, homophobic or racist or anti-Semitic, and to blame our allies for things. I have a 2.5-year-old daughter, Alex, and that's just not a country that I think I'm going to let my daughter grow up in, or anyone's sons or daughters or grandkids to grow up in. And I just think Democrats, we need sort of a different vision. We need a vision where everyone in this country can contribute to the best of their ability. I mean, I think that America is the greatest idea the world's ever had. And we've got to fight every day to make sure that everyone who wants to contribute to the idea that is America is able to. And that's a large portion of why I'm running. I grew up without a whole lot. My parents wanted us to go to college more than anything in the world, but we had no money at all. And my mom realized one day by accident that if she got a job at a local university, her kids could go to college for reduced tuition. So she learns this. She goes out and she buys a book and learns to type and gets a job as a receptionist at Duquesne University. And all three of the kids go to school there. And she got her degree there as well. I know what it's like to care about how much milk costs. I know what it's like not to have health insurance and have to have a doctor come pull your stitches out in your back porch. But I also know on the other side, I have a business degree. I've been working with companies for years to help them grow and help them, relocate to places where they can, where they have, good employee opportunities. I worked at the Pentagon for a bunch of years, putting big solar, wind, and biomass projects on Army bases. So I have a very good feeling for infrastructure finance as well, and the importance of solar and wind and renewable energy for national security purposes. Because it's interesting, when I started helping the Army put this stuff on government land, I thought it'd be great for the renewable energy industry, but really the people that cared about it the most was the military. What they really were concerned about is that, some terrorists would blow up a transformer on the outskirts of the base, and they really wanted the defendable energy source inside the base, like a solar or wind source that could power that base in times of war.
So you haven't worked in government directly, although you have worked on projects for the Pentagon. But why don't you explain how you think you can hit the ground running if elected to Congress, Ray?
I've worked in both the private and the public sector over my career. I have actually sort of developed an expertise in understanding issues that are important to both the private side and the public side and helping things actually get done. I spent a lot of time in my career before I worked at the Pentagon working with technology companies primarily who are trying to move into renewable energy. And so we spent a lot of time working on figuring out how to help these companies grow and then help them relocate to places sometimes within America with good and strong workforces and helping them create jobs. So I have a really good understanding of why companies, what's important to companies as they hire more people and as they go to places to search out people. So I have a very good feel of what we need to do around job training, incentives when we have to provide them. But on the other side too, I spent a lot of time doing policy work in Washington back in the early part of my career. And working with the Pentagon really gave me as well an understanding of how the private and public sector sort of can work together.
So Ray, this is an environmentally focused program. Why don't you explain some of your positions in terms of the environment and energy? You have a background in the renewable space, but you also are in Pennsylvania, which has a pretty lively natural gas industry. It has a long history of coal mining. You're not going to please everyone with these type of answers, but why don't you lay out your position in terms of energy solutions?
It is a little bit tricky here, but at the end of the day, I found very few people out here who are against the idea of progress. Very few coal miners out here that I've met want their kids and grandkids to work in the coal mines. They want to make sure that they can feed their kids between now and that point. In Western Pennsylvania, we have the National Energy Technology Laboratory. And you may know there are national laboratories all over the country. Some of them focus on, nuclear waste. Some of them focus on weaponry. The one here in southwestern Pennsylvania focuses on clean coal, the NETL, the National Energy Technology Laboratory. And they are very focused on carbon capture and storage technology. And the United Nations and the International Energy Agency have both said that even if we move forward with renewables at a good clip and even if we completely fulfilled President Obama's climate plan, we would still get the vast majority of our power from fossil fuels over the next 30 years. So they have both said, and I agree with the fact that to actually do right by the climate, we have to focus on some sort of carbon neutral technology that fossil fuel technology. And so I think that what we're doing down here with the National Energy Technology Laboratory could be very, very helpful. Not only could it help an easier transition from coal to full renewables, but it could also do that in a way where southwestern Pennsylvania becomes sort of the epicenter for this technology that is going to be used around the world. So I think it is good on both sides for the district and for this part of the state.
Well, good luck in the primary, which is May 15th. Ray Linzenmeyer, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Sammy Roth. Sammy's a reporter for the Desert Sun, based out of Palm Springs, California. Sammy, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Good to talk to you, Alex.
So you recently wrote a piece on desalination efforts in California. Is this something that you see is going to be happening anytime soon?
That's a good question. I think that the consensus that I sort of found when I was working on my article is that probably at some point in the future, not sure how soon that will be, but at some point there will be more desalination in California than there is now. That definitely there seems to be a move in that direction. I think that, it becomes much trickier when you start to talk about how much desalination and how soon are we going to need it, or how soon are we going to build it. On the one hand, you have in Carlsbad in San Diego County, the largest desal plant in the Western Hemisphere just opened up. It cost $1 billion. It's going to supply water to 300,000 people. And there's a similar one proposed in Huntington Beach, and then another, 13 or 14 additional plants that are proposed in various stages up and down the coast. People look out at the ocean and they say, well, we're in this dire drought right now. We have this water supply that's already very stretched thin by population and by urban growth and by agriculture and by environmental needs. And, we're in a desert and there's climate change, and these problems are probably only going to get worse. And so you have people who look out at the ocean and say, of course we should be tapping this resource. It's pretty endless. We can find the money to pay for it. We should make this a priority. On the other hand, you have a lot of pretty vocal critics of desalination who point out that one, it's very, very expensive, much more expensive than sort of other methods of stretching the water supply that are less controversial, things like water recycling and stormwater capture and just sort of plain old efficiency and conservation, like we've seen California do a lot of over the last year. It's also very energy intensive, and when you use energy frequently, that means burning greenhouse gases and contributing to climate change. You've also got potential impacts on marine life, both when you suck the water out from the ocean and when you sort of put the salty residue back in the ocean. There's a potential there, depending on how it's done, to impact larvae and sort of very, very young fish. So there are all of these questions that surround it and that make it sort of a more difficult answer than, yes, there's going to be more desalination, or no, there isn't going to be any. I think almost everyone will tell you that there's a role for it to play, even if it's a small role and even if it's not right away. But because of all of these issues, it's just very tricky to say how much of it is going to happen and when it's going to happen.
But it sounds like this project in Carlsbad is happening. Is that fair to say?
That's right. So the Carlsbad desalination plant, biggest one in the Western Hemisphere, it opened in November, or maybe they had the official opening in December, and it's, you know, it produces 50 million gallons of water per day, or it's capable of doing that. It cost $1 billion to build. They said in San Diego County that, they expected, you know, monthly water bills on average to go up by $5 or $7 a month. But you know, it's happening, and it's there, and it's operating, and I think as far as I've heard, it seems to be working as advertised. And so I know, I think that people are really going to be watching that plant, and you know, if people in San Diego like what they're getting and it's what they expected, you know, that would be something that would lend itself to arguments in favor of future desalination plants.
So that $1 billion price tag, is that just the startup costs, or is that also running it afterwards?
Yeah, I don't know what the expense of running it's going to be. I know that what they said was that the water bills for, you know, customers in San Diego County who are going to be paying for this, we're going to go up by something like $5 to $7 per month. And San Diego County Water Authority has agreed the sort of way that they were able to, you know, get a company to spend all of this money up front is that they've agreed to buy this water for 30 years, you know, at a constant rate, or not at a constant rate, it's tied to whatever else the price of water is elsewhere. But basically, they've agreed to buy this water for 30 years, sort of no matter what the water situation is otherwise in the state. So those are some of the things that I think, you know, helped give the developer Poseidon Resources the certainty to build.
Just when I read that number, besides the questions that it arose in whether or not this is a long-term cost versus a short-term outlay of capital, it also made me try to understand better how much water costs in context. Could you maybe give us a better idea of how much it costs to deliver water to 300,000 people without using desalination methods?
Good question. The numbers that I remember from the story that I worked on, and this was for Santa Barbara, San Diego, I'd honestly have to go and look it up. But what they told me in Santa Barbara was that they were paying, for the desalinated water, they were paying between $1,300 and $15 per acre foot. And an acre foot is the amount of water that it would take to cover an acre of land and 1 foot of water. It's sort of one of these wonky water units. So they were looking at 1,300 to 1,500 acre feet, and that was more expensive than every other type of water. They were paying, I want to say, $800 or something significantly less per acre foot to get water delivered to them from Northern California through the State Water Project. Even recycled water, which is, you know, relatively expensive still, they were paying, I think, $1,200 per acre foot, which is less. And, you know, for water that came from their local, you know, their Lake Kachuma, their reservoir near Santa Barbara, I think it was about $300 per acre foot. So it's, you know, it's definitely a bigger expense. One of the arguments that's been made, you know, in favor of spending that money is that, you know, when you look at these other water supplies, they're becoming less reliable, especially now in a drought. The, you know, the State Water Project isn't always delivering, or is very rarely delivering even a fraction of what people have been promised. The Colorado River is drying up. So a lot of people see desalination, even though it's significantly more expensive in some cases, as a little bit of a hedge against what's happening with the price of water elsewhere. And now that I, you know, say all that, I think I remember that in San Diego, they were actually going to be paying on the order of $2,000 per acre foot for the water. And so I couldn't translate that out to 300,000 people, but that was sort of the sort of per unit price.
And this whole technology in non-desert places seems to be a hedge, as you said. And it's tricky for municipalities to find that balance between a dire need and being prudent and planning for the future. Why don't you talk about some of the experience that Australia has had with desalination?
Yeah, so I mean, Australia was one of the, you know, one of the things I looked at in my article. And basically, in Australia, they had this drought called the Millennium Drought that, it lasted a very, very long time. I think it was about 15 years in the early or mid 90s that this drought really got underway, and it was still going into the late 2000s. And you know, so they said, we really need to do something serious. And so they built these six desalination plants, enormous, you know, massive. I think several of them, if not all of them, might have been bigger than the one in Carlsbad. And they spent a lot of money on that, several billion dollars, I believe. And they opened these plants. And then sort of the moment that they started producing water, The drought ended after all of that time, and since then, four of the six plants have just not operated at all because they, you know, they didn't need them, and because the water was so expensive to produce. And you know, it's interesting because as best as I, you know, as far as I've been told, it still is sort of a controversial issue in Australia, where you have some people who say, you know, this was such a waste of money. We never should have done this. We should have, you know, found other ways to stretch our water supply or to use less. And then on the other hand, you have people. I spoke to a professor at one of the universities there for my article who said, well, you know, it looks bad right now, but if you look at climate change and what is the future going to look like, I think that eventually we're going to use these, we're going to turn them back on, we're going to be glad that we have them. And that's kind of similar, honestly, to what happened in Santa Barbara, where the desal plant there, they actually built it in the early 1990s, sort of coming out of another serious drought, and they turned it on. Spent $35 million to build it, which for a city the size of Santa Barbara, that's, you know, that was a lot of money at the time, still is now. And they turned the thing on, and then the drought ended, and they said, gee, this is expensive, we have cheaper water elsewhere, so they turned it off. And now, 25 years later, they're paying a lot of money, I think $50 or $55 million now, even more than, you know, they paid to build the thing just to turn it back on, and it's going to be a couple million per year to operate. And so it's... you know, it's a very tricky question because I think they're, you know, the leadership in that city is glad that they have it and glad they have this option, and they think it's going to make sense long term. But they, you know, they did have this experience where they thought that once before, and they kind of regretted it, at least for a while.
And with this Carlsbad project, would it only be able to deliver water to the local 300,000 people that we're talking about, or is it possible to be able to ship that water to places deeper in the desert of California where drought is much more of a constant?
That's an interesting question. You know, with Carlsbad in particular, I'm not sure. I mean, it was built specifically for San Diego County, and that's where they're distributing the water. You know, I think what's interesting, though, is that, you know, one of the things I learned while reporting on this is that Las Vegas, which, as anyone, you know, everyone probably knows, is nowhere near an ocean, considers desalination sort of an important part of its long-term water supply picture, and what they, you know, they believe in Las Vegas is that at a certain point they're going to have to work with California or work with Mexico or some combination of thereof to, you know, make some sort of arrangement where desal plants or a desal plant or multiple are sort of being built on the coast to supply people on the coast, and then in exchange, if Las Vegas pays for that, you know, they think they'll hopefully be able to trade some of that water for water that California or Mexico has a right to from the Colorado River, which is much more proximal to them. So, you know, I don't know that that's something that can be applied, you know, everywhere up and down the state or in other places where you always have those situations where that kind of trading can be done, but definitely something that Las Vegas is interested in long term.
Sammy Roth from the Desert Sun, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You're welcome, Alex. Good talking to you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Wayne Shorter, Mose Allison, and John Martin. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.